3. When I pulled into the half-deserted strip mall where the base was located, I parked a few spots away from my boss Ray's gas-guzzling pride and joy, a red 1964 Ford Galaxy with a faded bumper sticker that read, "Starship Captains Do It on Impulse." As usual, the rest of the customer parking lot was empty, except for a small cluster of cars in front of Thai, the generically named Thai food restaurant at the other end of the strip mall, where Ray and I ordered copious amounts of takeout. We'd nicknamed the place Thai Fighter because the capital H on their sign had a circular bulge at its center that made the letter resemble an Imperial fighter with twin ion engines. The sign mounted over the entrance of Starbase Ace was a bit fancier. Ray had designed it to look like a real starbase was bursting out of the building's brick facade. It had cost him a fortune, but it did look cool as hell. As I pushed through the front door, the electronic chime Ray had rigged up to it activated, playing a sliding door sound effect from the original Star Trek TV series, making it sound like I was walking onto the bridge of the Enterprise. It still made me smile every time I arrived at work, even today. As I walked into the store, a pair of toy laser turrets mounted on the ceiling swiveled around to track me, activated by their primitive motion sensors. Ray had taped a sign to the wall beside them that read, "Warning, anyone caught shoplifting will be vaporized by our turbo lasers." Ray was in his usual spot behind the counter, hunched over Big Bootay, his ancient overclocked gaming PC. His left hand danced across its keyboard while he clicked the mouse with his right. "Zack is back for the attack," Ray bellowed, keeping his eyes on the game. "How is school, my man?" "Uneventful," I lied, joining him behind the counter. "How's business today?"
"Nice and slow, just like we like it," he said. "Dost thou care for a Funyun?"
He proffered a giant bag of these simulated onion rings, and I took one to be polite. Ray seemed to subsist primarily on a diet of high-fructose junk food and old video games. It was hard not to love the guy. Back before I was old enough to drive, I used to ride my bike over to Starbase Ace every day after school, just to bullshit about old video games with Ray and kill time until my mom got off work at the hospital. Either he recognized me as a kindred spirit, or he just got tired of my chronic latchkey kid loitering and eventually offered me a job. I was overjoyed, even before I discovered that my new position as assistant sales clerk involved about 10% actual work and about 90% hanging out with Ray while we played video games, cracked jokes, and ate junk food on the clock. Ray once told me that he operated Starbase Ace for kicks. After making a boatload of dough on tech stocks during the dot-com boom, he now wanted to enjoy his early retirement at the helm of his own private nerd lair, where he got to spend all day playing and talking about video games with his like-minded clientele. He was always saying he didn't give a damn if the store ever turned a profit, which was good because it rarely did. Ray paid way too much for the used games we bought, and then immediately priced them for less than he'd just paid for them. He put everything on sale all the time. He sold consoles, controllers, and hardware at no markup to, as he put it, foster customer loyalty and promote the gaming industry. Ray was also terrible at customer service. He made people wait at the register if he was in the middle of playing a game. He also loved to talk shit about people's game selections while he was ringing them up, if he thought they were buying a lame or easy title, and I'd seen him drive both children and adults out of the store with his opinions on everything from cheat codes to crop circles. He didn't seem to care if his rude behavior drove him out of business. I did, though, which made for a strange employee-employer relationship, since I was usually the one who had to scold him for not being more polite to our customers. I fished my Starbase Ace name tag out of a drawer and pinned it on. A few years ago, as a joke, Ray had put his nickname for me on there, so now it read, "Hello, my name is Zack Attack." He didn't know that Zack Attack was also the name my peers had saddled me with after the incident back in junior high. I stood there stalling for a few more minutes, then forced myself to walk over to Smallberries, our second enormous sales PC. I clicked its mouse a few times and opened a search engine. I glanced at Ray to make sure he wasn't looking my way, then typed in the words Beaverton, Oregon, UFO, and flying saucer. The only hits that came back were references to Flying Saucer Pizza, a local restaurant. There were no recent UFO sightings mentioned on the local TV station or newspaper websites. If anyone else had seen the same ship I had, they still hadn't reported it. Or maybe there had been a report, but no one had taken it seriously? I sighed and closed the browser window, then glanced back over at Ray. If there was anyone I could have told about the Glaive fighter, it was him. Ray seemed to believe that everything happening in the world was somehow connected to Roswell, Area 51, or Hangar 18. He'd told me on numerous occasions that he believed aliens had already made first contact with humanity decades ago, and that our leaders were still covering it up all these years later because the sheeple of Earth weren't ready to hear the truth yet. But UFO cover-ups and alien abductions were one thing. Seeing a fictional alien spacecraft from a best-selling video game series buzzing your town made even the craziest Roswell conspiracy theories seem sane by comparison. Besides, how was I supposed to walk over to Ray and tell him with a straight face that I'd seen a Sobra Kai fighter buzzing our town when he was, at that very moment, doing battle with that very same fictional alien race? I walked over to get a better view of his huge monitor. Ray was playing the same video game he'd been playing pretty much non-stop for the past few years. Terra Firma, a wildly popular first-person shooter published by Chaos Terrain, the same developer behind Armada. Both games shared the same near-future alien invasion storyline, in which Earth was being attacked by the Sobra Kai, a race of ill-tempered, anthropomorphic, squid-like creatures from Tau Ceti V, who were hell-bent on exterminating all of humanity for one of the usual bullshit reasons. They wanted our sweet-ass M-class planet, and sharing shit just wasn't in their cephalopod nature. Like nearly every race of evil alien invaders in the history of science fiction, the Sobra Kai were somehow technologically advanced enough to construct huge warships capable of crossing interstellar space, and yet still not smart enough to terraform a lifeless world to suit their needs, instead of going through the huge hassle of trying to conquer one that was already inhabited, especially one inhabited by billions of nuke-wielding apes who generally don't cotton to strangers being on their land. No, the Sobra Kai just had to have Earth for some reason, and they were determined to kill all humans before they took possession. Luckily for us, like so many made-up evil alien invaders before them, the Sobra Kai also seemed intent on exterminating us as slowly and inefficiently as possible. Instead of just wiping out humanity with a meteor or a killer virus or a few old-fashioned long-range nuclear weapons, the squids had opted to wage a prolonged World War II-style air and ground war against us, while somehow allowing all of their advanced weapons, propulsion, and communications technology to fall into their primitive enemies' hands. In both Armada and Terra Firma, you played a human recruit in the Earth Defense Alliance, tasked with using a variety of ground-based combat drones to fight off the invasion. Each drone in the EDA's arsenal was designed to serve as a direct match for a similar type of drone used by the alien enemy. Terra Firma focused on humanity's ground war against the Sobra Kai after their drones had reached Earth. Armada was an aerospace combat sim released the following year, allowing players to remotely control humanity's global stockpile of defense drones and use them to battle the Sobra Kai invaders out in space and over the besieged cities of Earth. Since their release, Terra Firma and Armada had become two of the most popular multiplayer action games in the world. I'd played TF religiously when it came out, until Chaos Terrain released Armada the following year, and then it had become my primary video game obsession. I still played Terra Firma with Cruz and Deal a few times a week, usually in return for them agreeing to play an Armada mission with me. Ray also frequently coerced me into playing TF with him here at work, so my infantry drone skills were still sharp. This was essential because in Terra Firma, the size and power of the drones you were allowed to control during each mission was based on your overall combat skill rating. Newbie players were only authorized to operate the smallest and cheapest combat drones in the EDA's arsenal. Once you increased in rank and skill, you were allowed to pilot increasingly bigger and more advanced drones. Spartan hover tanks, Nautiloid attack submarines, Sentinels, 10-foot-tall super aethids with more firepower, and the EDA's largest and most impressive weapon, the Titan War Mech, a giant humanoid robot that looked like something out of an old Japanese anime. Ray happened to be controlling a war mech at that very moment, and he was in trouble. I watched as a horde of alien spider fighters closed in on him. His mech finally succumbed to the incoming barrage of laser fire and toppled backward into a large tenement building, demolishing it. He and I both winced, and Terra Firma players got penalized for all of the property damage caused by their drones in combat, intentional or otherwise. Although the game's backstory embraced a lot of tired alien invasion tropes, it subverted many of them too. For example, the Sobrakai weren't actually invading Earth in person. They were using drones to do it. And humanity had constructed its own stockpile of drones to repel them. So all of the aerospace fighters, mechs, tanks, subs, and ground troops used by both sides were remotely controlled war machines, each one operated by an alien or human who was physically located somewhere far from the battlefield. From a purely tactical standpoint, using drones made a hell of a lot more sense than using manned or aliened ships and vehicles to wage an interplanetary war. Why risk the lives of your best pilots by sending them into combat? Now, whenever I watched a Star Wars film, I found myself wondering how the Empire had the technology to make long-distance holographic phone calls between planets light years apart, and yet no one had figured out how to make a remote-controlled TIE fighter or X-Wing yet. A warning message flashed on Ray's HUD. Your drone has been destroyed. Then his display went dark for a second before a new message flashed on his HUD, informing him that he had just been given control of a new drone. But, since all of his unit's larger drones and tanks had already been destroyed, Ray was forced to take control of the only thing they had left, an Aethid, armored tactical humanoid infantry drone. From the neck down, an Aethid looked similar to the original Terminator after all of Arnie's cyborg flesh got burned away, leaving only its armored chrome skeleton underneath. But in place of a human-shaped head, each Aethid had a stereoscopic camera encased inside an armored acrylic dome, giving it a vaguely insect-like appearance. Every Aethid was armed with a Gauss minigun mounted on each forearm, a pair of shoulder-mounted missile launchers, and a laser cannon embedded in its chest plate. I watched over Ray's shoulder as he used his Aethid's twin miniguns to mow down an onslaught of Sobrakai spider fighters, eight-legged anti-personnel robots that were attacking him on the roof of a burning tenement building, somewhere near the center of the besieged city he was helping defend. He was bobbing his head in time to his favorite TF battle soundtrack song, Vital Signs by Rush. Ray claimed that its unique time signature matched up perfectly with the alien spider fighter drone's erratic swarming patterns, making it easier for him to anticipate their movements and rate of attack. He also claimed that each of the other songs on Rush's Moving Pictures album was perfect for battling a different Sobrakai drone. Personally, I'd always assumed this was just an excuse he'd concocted for playing that same album on a continuous loop day after day. On Ray's monitor, dozens of Sobrakai troop ships were descending from the sky. These massive gunmetal gray octahedrons were what the enemy used to deploy their ground forces once they reached Earth's orbit. Each one had automated sentry guns mounted all over its heavily armored hull, which was nearly invulnerable to laser fire. Of course, in typical video game fashion, these ships had been engineered with a glaring weak spot. Their engines were unshielded and vulnerable to attack, a fact I knew well from playing Armada. When one of these diamond-shaped troop ships made landfall, it would impact with enough velocity to bury its lower half into the surface, like a giant spike. Then the pyramid-shaped top half would open like an enormous four-petaled metal flower, and the thousands of Sobrakai drones packed inside it would pour out, like an army of newborn insects bursting from a broken egg sac, intent on devouring everything in sight. In the distance, a swarm of Sobrakai glaive fighters streaked across the sky, banking in unison to change course, like a school of piranha in search of prey. Viewed from above, the glaive's symmetrical fuselage resembled the blade of a double-headed axe. But seen edge-on, its profile distinctly resembled that of a flying saucer from an old sci-fi film, a detail that had worked its way into my earlier hallucination. I'd destroyed countless glaive fighters during the 3 years I'd been playing Armada. Until now, I'd never found them especially frightening or ominous. But today, just seeing the background animations on Ray's screen filled me with a sense of dread, as if the ships really were somehow a threat to everything I held dear, and not a harmless collection of textured polygons rendered on a computer display. Ray power-leaped his aethid off of the burning rooftop and onto the back of a Sobrakai Basilisk, a reptilian-looking robot tank with laser cannons for eyes. Ray power-jumped into the air again, spinning his aethid around 180 degrees just before he brought the huge metal basilisk down with a single, well-placed missile shot to its segmented abdomen. It exploded beneath him in a huge orange fireball, and Ray had to fire his aethid's jump jets again to land clear of it. "Bravo, Sergeant," I said, using his rank in the fictional Earth Defense Alliance. "Thank you, Lieutenant," he replied. "I'm doing my best, sir." He grinned and raised his right hand off of his mouse long enough to snap me a salute before refocusing on the battle. According to the readouts on his HUD, his squadron had already lost all six of their hover tanks and both of their Titans. They only had seven aethids left in reserve, and the pulsing icons on his tactical map indicated these were stored inside a nearby EDA weapons cache that was already under attack by a swarm of spider fighters. Ray's squadron was fighting a losing battle at this point. The city would fall to the Sobrakai any minute now. But as usual, Ray kept on fighting, even in the face of certain defeat. It was one of his most endearing qualities. Ray was, by far, the best Terra Firma player I'd ever seen in person. A few months ago, he'd finally managed to earn membership in the 30 Dozen, an elite clan of the best 360 players in the game. Since then, I'd seen him logged on to Terraformers servers every day, playing one high-level mission after another. And since he wasn't burdened with distractions like school or homework, Ray could devote his every waking moment to the game. So he'd logged more combat time than me, Cruz, and Deal all put together. "Son of a bitch!" Ray shouted, hitting the side of his monitor. I glanced over and saw that the Sobrakai were currently overrunning the surviving members of his squadron and exterminating the last of their drones. A few seconds after Ray's last reserve aethid was crushed between a spider fighter's vice-like mandibles, the words "Mission Failed" flashed on his display, and then he was treated to a cutscene animation of the Sobrakai's forces destroying downtown Newark. "Oh well," he muttered, shoving another mouthful of Funyuns into his face as he pondered the city's smoking ruins. "At least it's only Newark, right? No big loss." He chuckled to himself as he wiped simulated onion dust off his fingers and onto the legs of his jeans. Then he gave me an excited grin. "Hey, guess what came in today?" he asked. Then he produced a large box from underneath the counter and set it in front of me. If I'd been a cartoon character, my eyes would have bulged out of their sockets. It was a brand new Armada Interceptor Flight Control System, the most advanced and expensive video game controller ever made. "No way!" I whispered, examining the photos and stats printed on its glossy black box. "I thought these things weren't supposed to hit the market until next month." "Looks like Chaos Terrain decided to ship them early," he said, rubbing his hands together excitedly. "Want to unbox this bad boy?" I nodded my head vigorously, and Ray grabbed a packing knife. He cut the box open and then instructed me to hold on to its sides as he pulled out the styrofoam cube housing the controller's various components. A few seconds later, everything was freed from the packaging and laid out on the glass countertop in front of us. The Armada Interceptor Flight Control System, IFCS, contained an interceptor pilot helmet, incorporating a set of built-in VR goggles, noise-canceling headphones, and a retractable microphone, and a two-piece HOTUS, hands-on throttle and stick, rig, comprised of an all-metal force-feedback flight stick and a separate dual-throttle controller with a built-in weapons control panel. The stick, throttle, and weapons panel all bristled with ergonomic buttons, triggers, indicators, mode selectors, rotary dials, and eight-way hat studs, each of which could be configured to give you total control of your Armada Interceptor's flight, navigation, and weapons systems. "You likey, Zach?" Ray asked after watching me drool over it for a while. "Ray, I want to marry this thing." "We've got over a dozen more back in the stockroom," he said. "Maybe we can build a display pyramid out of them or something." I picked up the helmet and hefted it, impressed by its weight and detail. It looked and felt like a real fighter pilot helmet, and its Oculus Rift components were state-of-the-art. I had a half-decent VR headset at home that Ray had gifted me, but it was a few years old, and the display resolution had increased drastically since then. "These new helmets can read your thoughts, too," Ray joked. "But you have to think in Russian." I laughed and set the helmet back on the counter, resisting the urge to try it on. Then, I reached out and rested my left hand on the throttle controller, while I wrapped my right hand around the cold metal of the attached flight stick. Both seemed like a perfect fit, as if they'd been machined to match my hands. I'd been playing Armada for years, and the whole time I'd been using a cheap plastic flight stick and throttle controller. I'd had no idea what I'd been missing. I'd coveted an IFCS ever since I heard they were coming out on the Armada forums, but the price tag was somewhere north of $500. Even with my 10% employee discount, that was still way too rich for my blood. I reluctantly slid my hands off the controllers and shoved them into my pockets. "If I start saving up now, I might be able to afford one by the end of the summer," I muttered. "That is, if my crapmobile doesn't break down again." Ray mimed playing a violin. Then he smiled and slid the helmet across the counter to me. "You can have this one," he said. "Consider it an early graduation gift." He elbowed me playfully. "You are going to graduate, right?"
"No way,"
I said, staring at the controller in disbelief. Then I looked up at Ray. "I mean, yes, I'll graduate, but..."
"You're not kidding? I can have this one? For reals?"
Ray nodded solemnly. "For reals." I felt like hugging him, so I did, throwing my arms around his thick midsection in a fierce embrace. He laughed uncomfortably and patted me on the back until I finally let go of him. "I'm only doing it because it's good for the war effort," he said, straightening his flannel shirt and then ruffling my hair in retaliation. "Having your own flight control system might make you an even better interceptor pilot, if that's even possible."
"Ray, this is way too generous," I said. "Thank you."
Don't mention it, kid." Although I'd been worrying for years that Ray's runaway altruism would drive him bankrupt and that I'd be forced to go find a real job somewhere, it didn't stop me from accepting his latest extravagant gift. "Want to head back to the war room and give it a spin?" He motioned to the small, cramped back room where dozens of linked PCs and gaming consoles were set up. Customers rented the war room out for LAN parties and clan events. "You could work out the kinks before that big elite mission later tonight." "No thanks," I said. "I think I'll just wait and try it out then on my home setup. Because I might flip out or start foaming at the mouth the next time I see a glaive fighter coming at me, and I'd rather be alone in my bedroom if and when it happens." He cocked an eyebrow at me. "What's wrong with you?" he said. "You sick?" I looked away. "No, I'm fine," I replied. "Why?" "Your boss just offered you a chance to play your favorite video game at work on the clock, and you turn it down?" He reached out to touch my forehead. "You got a brain fever or something, kid?" I laughed uneasily and shook my head. No, it's just, I recently vowed to stop goofing off so much here at work, regardless of how much you encourage me to.
Why in the hell would you do that?
It's all part of my master plan, I said, to show you how responsible and reliable I've become so you'll hire me on as a full-time employee after I graduate. He shot me the same perturbed look he always seemed to give me whenever I brought up this subject.
Zach, you can work here for as long as we manage to stay in business, he said. Honestly, though, you have to know you're destined for much bigger things, right?
Thanks, Ray, I said, struggling not to roll my eyes. If today was any indication, the only thing I was destined for was a straitjacket. Maybe a padded helmet, too.
You cannot escape your destiny, he said in his best Obi-Wan.
Then he collapsed back onto his stool and fired up another Terra Firma mission with a click of his mouse. Chaos Terrain manufactured a wide variety of Terra Firma controllers, including the best-selling Titan Control System, a dual flight stick rig that we sold right here in the store. But Ray never played with anything but a keyboard and mouse. He also still preferred a two-dimensional computer monitor to VR goggles, which he claimed gave him vertigo. Like a lot of gamers his age, Ray was set in his ways. In spite of what I just said to him, I walked back over to Smallberry's and clicked the Terra Firma icon on its desktop. The game's opening cutscene began, and I almost hit skip intro out of habit, but then I let it play, rewatching it for the first time in years. The intro's somber opening voiceover, performed by Morgan Freeman, killing it like always, briefly laid out the game's basic storyline. It was set sometime in the mid-21st century, roughly 10 years after Earth was invaded by the Sobrakai, an aquatic race hailing from the Tau Ceti star system, a popular point of origin for aliens since the dawn of sci-fi due to its close proximity to Earth. The Sobrakai somewhat resembled the giant squids of Earth, but with an added mane of spiked tentacles and a vertical shark-like mouth ringed by six soulless black eyes. The game's intro segued into a video transmission the invaders had sent to humanity on the day of their arrival, containing a threatening message from the Sobrakai overlord, whose Weta designers had gone way too Geiger, in my humble opinion. The gray, translucent-skinned creature was shown floating in its dark underwater lair, its tentacles splayed out behind it, addressing the camera in its grating native language, which sounded sort of like a whale song if the whale in question was into death metal. Thankfully, someone turned on the English subtitles just before the overlord began to make his evil alien species somewhat cliched intentions known.
We are the Sobrakai, it said. And we declare your pitiful species to be unworthy of survival. You shall therefore be eradicated.
There was more to the overlord's message, but I hit the space bar to skip over it. I remembered the highlights. These malevolent, unfeeling inkfish had traveled 12 light years across interstellar space to wipe out humanity and then knock down all of our Pizza Huts so that they could seize our rare blue jewel as a world of their own. It was my mission to use my baller video game skills to stop them. Boo-yah! Press fire to continue. The whole convoluted backstory behind humanity's ongoing war with the Sobrakai was available online, but gamers had to piece it together by digging through an elaborate network of Earth Defense Alliance websites, an alternate reality game element meant to help players immerse themselves in the game's narrative. According to the information buried on those sites, at some point during the onset of the Sobrakai invasion a decade ago, the EDA had somehow managed to capture one of the aliens' ships undamaged, and then they had reverse-engineered all of its incredibly advanced weaponry, communication, life support, and propulsion technology, seemingly overnight, and then used it to construct a massive global arsenal of combat drones that were capable of going toe-to-toe with the Sobrakai. Of course, the developers never bothered to explain how the EDA's scientists managed to accomplish these amazing feats in such a short time span while fending off constant attacks from the Sobrukai's vastly superior technology. But the way I saw it, if you were willing to suspend your disbelief enough to believe that a race of anthropomorphic extraterrestrial squids from Tau Ceti had been using an armada of remote-controlled robots to wage war on humanity for the past decade, it was pretty silly to nitpick over plot holes and scientific inaccuracies, especially if they justified evil alien overlords and dogfighting in space. I closed the Terra Firma client and opened a web browser. Then I pulled up Chaos Terrain's website. I clicked through to their website's About Us page and scanned it. As a longtime CT superfan, I already knew quite a lot about the company's history. It had been founded back in 2010 by a Bay Area video game developer named Finn Arbogast, who quit a lucrative job working on the Battlefield series for Electronic Arts to venture out on his own. He founded Chaos Terrain with the lofty goal of creating the next generation of multiplayer VR games. Arbogast had then assembled a dream team of creative consultants and contractors to help make his bold claim a reality, luring some of the video game industry's brightest stars away from their own companies and projects with the sole promise of collaborating on his groundbreaking new MMOs. That was how gaming legends like Chris Roberts, Richard Garriott, Hidetaka Miyazaki, Gabe Newell, and Shigeru Miyamoto had all wound up as consultants on both Terra Firma and Armada, along with several big Hollywood filmmakers, including James Cameron, who had contributed to the EDA's realistic ship and mech designs, and Peter Jackson, whose Weta workshop had rendered all of the in-game cinematics. Chaos Terrain had created its own custom games engine for both Terra Firma and Armada, using many of the same programmers who had worked on previous combat simulation games like Battlefield, Call of Duty, and Modern Warfare, and on existing aerial and space combat simulators like Star Citizen, Elite Dangerous, and EVE Online. This plagiaristic, Frankenstein-like development strategy proved wildly successful. Terra Firma and Armada were two of the best-selling multiplayer video games in the world, and with good reason. Their stripped-down arcade-style gameplay made both titles easy to learn and fun for casual players, but they were also scalable and dynamic enough to be challenging for everyday players like myself. Both games also had killer production values, and they could be played on any modern gaming platform, including smartphones and tablets. Best of all, the games weren't overpriced like most MMOs. Sure, Chaos Terrain charged a low monthly subscription fee to play both Terra Firma and Armada, but once you got good enough to achieve the rank of officer in either game, CT waived your monthly fee and you played for free from then on. And they didn't use in-game microtransactions to milk players for extra revenue either. I closed the window and stared at the icons on the desktop, trying to sort out my thoughts. Until today, it had never occurred to me to make a connection between the alien invasion plotline of Chaos Terrain's games and the conspiracy theory outlined in my father's notebook. There were hundreds of alien invasion-themed movies, shows, books, and video games released every year, and Armada was just one of them. Besides, the game had only been out for a few years, so how could it possibly be connected to the stuff my father had written in his notebook decades ago? On the other hand, if the government really did want to train average citizens to operate drones in combat, then multiplayer combat games like Armada and Terra Firma would be exactly the sort of games you'd create to do it. When the Star Trek door chime sounded a few minutes later, and a gaggle of semi-regulars from the nearby junior high filed into the store, I shoved my new helmet, throttle, and flight stick controllers back into their box and stowed it under the counter before any of the prepubescent hooligans could lay their covetous eyes upon it. "Welcome to Starbase Ace, where the game is never over," I said, reciting the store's canned greeting with as much enthusiasm as I could muster. How may I help you, young gentleman, this evening?